continued. The salve I used wasn't a cure. It will only slow down your condition. My condition. What a wonderful euphemism for turning into a walking corpse. And if I do want a cure? I asked. Which, by the way, I do. That's going to take more powerful healing than I'm capable of, he confessed. God-level healing. I felt like crying. I decided Prangel needed to work on his bedside manner, perhaps by having a better collection of miraculous over-the-counter cures that did not require divine intervention.
We could try more horn shavings, Meg suggested. That's fun. I mean, that might work.
Between Meg's anxiousness to use the cheese grater and Buster's hungry stare, I was starting to feel like a plate of pasta. I don't suppose you have any leads on available healing gods. Actually, Prangel said, if you're feeling up to it, you should get dressed and have Meg walk you to the Principia. Raina and Frank are anxious to talk to you. Meg took pity on me. Before meeting the Praetors, she took me back to Bombilo's so I could wash up and change clothes. Afterward, we stopped by the Legion mess hall for food. Judging from the angle of the sun and the near-empty dining room, I guessed it was late afternoon, between lunch and dinner, which meant I'd been unconscious for almost a full day. The day after tomorrow, then, would be April 8th, the blood moon. Lester's birthday, the day two evil emperors and an undead king attacked Camp Jupiter. On the bright side, the mess hall was serving fish sticks. When I was done with my meal, here's a culinary secret I discovered. Ketchup really enhances fries and fish sticks. Meg escorted me down the Via Praetoria to Legion headquarters. Most of the Romans seemed to be off doing whatever Romans did in the late afternoon. Marching, digging trenches, playing Fortius Nitius. I wasn't really sure. The few legionnaires we passed stared at me as we walked by, their conversations sputtering to a stop. I guessed word had spread about our adventure in Tarquin's tomb. Perhaps they'd heard that I had a slight turning into a zombie problem, and they were waiting for me to scream for brains. The thought made me shudder. My gut wound felt so much better at the moment. I could walk without cringing. The sun was shining. I'd eaten a good meal. How could I still be poisoned? Denial is a powerful thing. Unfortunately, I suspected Prangel was right. He had only slowed down the infection. My condition was beyond anything that camp healers, Greek or Roman, could solve. I needed godly help, which was something Zeus had expressly forbidden the other gods to give me. The guards at the Praetorium led us through immediately. Inside, Raina and Frank sat behind a long table, laden with maps, books, daggers, and a large jar of jelly beans. Against the back wall, in front of a purple curtain, stood the Legion's golden eagle, humming with energy. Being so near to it made the hairs on my arm stand up. I didn't know how the Praetors could tolerate working here with that thing right behind them. Hadn't they read the medical journal articles about the effects of long-term exposure to electromagnetic Roman standards? Frank appeared ready for battle in his full armor. Raina looked like she was the one who'd just woken up. She wore her purple cloak, hastily pulled over a too-large Puerto Rico Fuerte t-shirt, which I wondered if she'd slept in. But that was none of my business. The left side of her hair was an adorable, fuzzy black mess of cowlicks that made me wonder if she slept on that side. And again, that was none of my business. Curled on the carpet at her feet were two automatons I hadn't seen before. A pair of greyhounds, one gold and one silver. They both raised their heads when they saw me, then sniffed the air and growled as if to say, "Hey, Mom, this guy smells like zombie. Can we kill him?" Reyna hushed them. She dug some jelly beans out of the jar and tossed them to the dogs. I wasn't sure why metallic greyhounds would like candy, but they snapped up the morsels, then settled their heads back on the carpet. Nice dogs, I said. Why haven't I seen them before? Aurum and Argentum have been out searching, Reyna said, in a tone that discouraged follow-up questions. How is your wound? My wound is thriving, I said. Me, not so much. He's better than before, Meg insisted. I grated some unicorn horn shavings on his cut. It was fun. Prangel helped too, I said. Frank gestured at the two visitors' seats.
You guys make yourselves comfortable.
Comfortable was a relative term. The three-legged foldable stools did not look as cushy as the Praetor's chairs. They also reminded me of the Oracle's tripod seat in Delphi, which reminded me of Rachel Elizabeth Dare back at Camp Half-Blood, who was not so patiently waiting for me to restore her powers of prophecy. Thinking about her reminded me of the Delphic cave, which reminded me of Python, which reminded me of my nightmare and how scared I was of dying. I hate stream of consciousness. Once we were seated, Reyna spread a parchment scroll across the table. So, we've been working with Ella and Tyson since yesterday, trying to decipher some more lines of prophecy.
We've made progress, Frank added. We think we found the recipe you were talking about at the Senate meeting, the ritual that could summon divine aid to save the camp.
That's great, right?
Meg reached for the jar of jelly beans, but retracted her hand when Aurum and Argentum began growling.
Maybe.
Reyna exchanged a worried look with Frank. The thing is, if we're reading the lines correctly, the ritual requires a death sacrifice. The fish sticks began sword fighting with the French fries in my stomach.
That can't be right, I said. We gods would never ask you mortals to sacrifice one of your own. We gave that up centuries ago. Or millennia ago, I can't remember. But I'm sure we gave it up.
Frank gripped his armrests.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not a mortal who's supposed to die.
No. Reyna locked eyes with me. It seems this ritual requires the death of a god.
Chapter 19. O book, what's my fate? What is the secret of life? See Appendix F.
Why was everybody looking at me?
I couldn't help it if I was the only ex-god in the room.
Reyna leaned over the scroll, tracing her finger across the parchment. Frank copied these lines from Tyson's back. As you can probably guess, they read more like an instruction manual than a prophecy. I was about to crawl out of my skin. I wanted to rip the scroll away from Reyna and read the bad news myself. Was my name mentioned? Sacrificing me couldn't possibly please the gods, could it? If we Olympians started sacrificing one another, that would set a terrible precedent. Meg eyed the jar of jelly beans, while the greyhounds eyed her.
Which god dies?
Well, that particular line. Reyna squinted, then pushed the parchment over to Frank. What is that word? Frank looked sheepish.
Shattered. Sorry, I was writing fast.
No, it's fine. Your handwriting is better than mine.
Can you please just tell me what it says?
I begged. Right, sorry, Reyna said. Well, it's not exactly poetry, like the sonnet you got in Indianapolis.
Reyna!
Okay. It says, All to be done on the day of greatest need. Gather the ingredients for a Type 6 burnt offering. See Appendix B.
We're doomed,
I wailed. We'll never be able to collect those, whatever they are.
That part's easy, Frank assured me. Ella has the list of ingredients. She says it's all ordinary stuff.
He gestured for Raina to continue.
Add the last breath of the god who speaks not, once his soul is cut free.
Raina read aloud.
Together with the shattered glass. Then the single deity summoning prayer, see Appendix C, must be uttered through the rainbow.
She took a breath. We don't have the actual text of that prayer yet, but Ella is confident she can transcribe it before the battle starts. Now that she knows what to look for in Appendix C.
Frank glanced at me for a reaction. Does the rest of it make any sense to you?
I was so relieved I almost slumped off my three-legged stool.
You got me all worked up.
I thought, well, I've been called a lot of things, but never the god who speaks not.
It sounds like we must find the soundless god, whom we've discussed before, and...
Kill him? Raina asked. How would killing a god please the gods? I didn't have an answer to that. Then again, many prophecies seemed illogical until they played out. Only in retrospect did they appear obvious. Perhaps if I knew which god we are talking about... I pounded my fist on my knee. I feel like I should know, but it's buried deep. An obscure memory. I don't suppose you've checked your libraries or run a Google search or something?
Of course we looked, Frank said. There's no listing for a Roman or Greek god of silence.
Roman or Greek? I felt sure I was missing something. Like part of my brain, for instance. Last breath. His soul is cut free.
It definitely sounded like instructions for a sacrifice. I have to think on it, I decided. As for the rest of the instructions, shattered glass seems like an odd request, but I suppose we can find some easily enough.
We could break the jelly bean jar, Meg suggested.
Raina and Frank politely ignored her.
And the single deity summoning thing, Frank asked. I guess that means we won't be getting a host of gods charging down in their chariots.
Probably not, I agreed. But my pulse quickened. The possibility of being able to speak to even one fellow Olympian after all this time, to summon actual grade AA quality, jumbo, cage-free, locally sourced divine help, I found the idea both exhilarating and terrifying. Would I get to choose which god I called? Or was it predetermined by the prayer? Nevertheless, even one god can make all the difference. Meg shrugged.
Depends on the god.
That hurt, I said. What about the last line? Raina asked. The prayer must be uttered through the rainbow.
An iris message, I said.
Happy I could answer one question at least. It's a Greek thing. A way of beseeching Iris, goddess of the rainbow, to carry a message. In this case, a prayer to Mount Olympus. The formula is quite simple.
But, Frank frowned, Percy told me about Iris messages. They don't work anymore, do they? Not since all our communications went silent.
Communications, I thought. Silent. The soundless god. I felt as if I'd fallen into the deep end of a very cold pool.
Oh, I am so stupid.
Meg giggled, but she resisted the many sarcastic comments that no doubt were filling her mind. I, in turn, resisted the urge to push her off her stool. This soundless god, whoever he is, What if he's the reason our communications don't work? What if the triumvirate has somehow been harnessing his power to prevent us all from talking to one another, and to keep us from beseeching the gods for help?
Reyna crossed her arms, blocking out the word fuerte on her t-shirt.
You're saying what? This soundless god is in cahoots with the triumvirate? We have to kill him to open our means of communication?
Then we could send an Iris message, do the ritual, and get divine help.
I'm still stuck on the whole killing a god thing. I considered the Erythrian Sibyl, whom we'd rescued from her prison in the burning maze. Perhaps this god isn't a willing participant.
He might have been trapped, or, I don't know, coerced somehow.
So we free him by killing him? Frank asked.
Gotta agree with Reyna. That sounds harsh.
One way to find out, Meg said. We go to this Sutro place. Can I feed your dogs?
Without waiting for permission, she grabbed the jelly bean jar and popped it open.
Aurum and Argentum, having heard the magic words feed and dogs, did not growl or tear Meg apart. They got up, moved to her side, and sat watching her, their jeweled eyes sending the message, please, please, please. Meg doled out a jelly bean for each dog, then ate two herself. Two for the dogs, two for herself. Meg had achieved a major diplomatic breakthrough. Meg's right. Sutro is the place Tarquin's minion mentioned, I recalled. Presumably we'll find the soundless god there.
Mount Sutro? Reyna asked. Or Sutro Tower? Did he say which?
Frank raised an eyebrow.
Isn't it the same place? I always just call that area Sutro Hill.
Actually, the biggest hill is Mount Sutro, said Reyna. The giant antenna is on a different hill right next to it. That's Sutro Tower. I only know this because Aurum and Argentum like to go hiking over there.
The greyhounds turned their heads at the word hiking, then went back to studying Meg's hand in the jelly bean jar. I tried to imagine Reyna hiking with her dogs just for fun. I wondered if Lavinia knew that was her pastime. Maybe Lavinia was such a dedicated hiker because she was trying to outdo the praetor, the same way she had her thinking spot high above Reyna's. Then I decided that trying to psychoanalyze my pink-haired, tap-dancing, Manu Ballista-wielding friend was probably a losing proposition.
Is this Sutro place close?
Meg was slowly depleting all the green jelly beans, which was giving her a different sort of green thumb than usual.
It's across the bay in San Francisco, Reyna said. The tower is massive. You can see it from all over the Bay Area.
Weird place to keep someone, Frank said.
But I guess no weirder than under a carousel.
I tried to remember if I'd ever been to Sutro Tower, or any of the other various Sutro-labeled places in that vicinity. Nothing came to mind, but the instructions from the Sibylline books had left me deeply unsettled. The last breath of a god was not an ingredient most ancient Roman temples kept in their pantries. And cutting a god's soul free really was not something Romans were supposed to try without adult supervision. If the soundless god was part of the triumvirate's scheme for control, why would Tarquin have access to him? What had Tarquin meant by doubling the flock to guard the god's location? And what he'd said about the Sibyl. I hope the Sibyl lasts long enough to see you humbled. That may be what finally breaks her. Had he just been messing with my mind?
If the Sibyl of Cumi was truly still alive, a captive of Tarquin, I was obligated to help her.
Help her.
The cynical part of my mind responded, like you helped her before? Wherever the soundless god is, I said, he'll be heavily protected, especially now. Tarquin must know we'll try to locate the hiding place.
And we have to do so on April 8th, said Reyna. the day of greatest need.
Frank grunted. Good thing we don't have anything else scheduled that day. Like getting invaded on two fronts, for instance.
My gods, Meg, Raina said. You're going to make yourself sick. I'll never get all the sugar out of Aurum and Argentum's gearworks. Fine.
Meg put the jelly bean jar back on the table, but not before grabbing one last fistful for herself and her canine accomplices.
So we have to wait until the day after tomorrow? What do we do until then?
Oh, we've got plenty to do, Frank promised. Planning, constructing defenses, war games all day tomorrow. We have to run the Legion through every possible scenario. Besides...
His voice faltered, as if he'd realized he was about to say something aloud that was best left in his head.
His hand drifted toward the pouch where he held his firewood.
I wondered if he'd taken any additional notes from Ella and Tyson. Perhaps more harpy ramblings about bridges, fires, and something, something, something. If so, Frank apparently didn't want to share.
Besides, he started over, you guys should rest up for the quest. You'll have to leave for Sutro early on Lester's birthday.
Can we please not call it that? I pleaded. Also, who is you guys? Raina asked. We may need another Senate vote to decide who goes on the quest.
Nah, Frank said. I mean, we can check with the senators, but this is clearly an extension of the original mission, right? Besides, when we're at war, you and I have full executive power.
Raina regarded her colleague. Why, Frank Shang, you've been studying the Praetor's Handbook.
Maybe a little. Frank cleared his throat. Anyway, we know who needs to go. Apollo, Meg, and you. The doorway to the Soundless God has to be opened by Bellona's daughter, right?
But, Raina looked back and forth between us. I can't just leave on the day of a major battle. Bellona's power is all about strength in numbers. I need to lead the troops.
And you will, Frank promised. As soon as you get back from San Francisco. In the meantime, I'll hold down the fort. I've got this.
Raina hesitated, but I thought I detected a gleam in her eye. Are you sure, Frank? I mean, yeah, of course you can do it. I know you can, but...
I'll be fine.
Frank smiled like he meant it.
Apollo and Meg need you on this quest. Go.
Why did Raina look so excited? How crushing her work must have been if, after carrying the burden of leadership for so long, she was looking forward to going on an adventure across the bay to kill a god. I suppose, she said with obviously feigned reluctance.
It's settled then.
Frank turned to Meg and me.
You guys rest up. Big day tomorrow. We'll need your help with the war games. I've got a special job in mind for each of you.
Chapter 20. Hamster Ball of Death. Spare me your fiery doom. I'm not feeling it. Oh boy, a special job. The anticipation was killing me. Or maybe that was the poison in my veins. As soon as I returned to the coffee shop's attic, I crashed on my cot. Meg huffed. It's still light outside. You slept all day. Not turning into a zombie is hard work. I know, she snapped. I'm sorry. I looked up, surprised by her tone. Meg kicked an old paper latte cup across the room. She plopped onto her cot and glared at the floor. Meg? In her flower box, irises grew with such speed that their flowers crackled open like corn kernels. Just a few minutes ago, Meg had been happily insulting me and gorging on jelly beans. Now? Was she crying? Meg, I sat up, trying not to wince. Meg, you're not responsible for me getting hurt.
She twisted the ring on her right hand, then the one on her left, as if they'd become too small for her fingers.
I just thought, if I could kill him.
She wiped her nose.
Like in some stories, you kill the master and you can free the people he's turned.
It took a moment for her words to sink in. I was pretty sure the dynamic she was describing applied to vampires, not zombies, but I understood what she meant.
You're talking about Tarquin, I said. You jumped into the throne room because you wanted to save me?
Duh, she muttered, without any heat. I put my hand over my bandaged abdomen. I'd been so angry with Meg for her recklessness in the tomb. I'd assumed she was just being impulsive, reacting to Tarquin's plans to let the Bay Area burn. But she'd leaped into battle for me, with the hope that she could kill Tarquin and erase my curse. That was even before I'd realized how bad my condition was. Meg must have been more worried, or more intuitive, than she'd let on. Which certainly took all the fun out of criticizing her.
Oh, Meg. I shook my head. That was a crazy, senseless stunt. And I love you for it. But don't beat yourself up.
Prangel's medicine bought me some extra time. And you did too, of course, with your cheese grating skills and your magical chickweed.
You've done everything you could.
When we summon godly help, I can ask for complete healing.
I'm sure I'll be as good as new, or at least as good as a Lester can be.
Meg tilted her head, making her crooked glasses just about horizontal.
How can you know? Is this God going to give us 3 wishes or something?
I considered that. When my followers called, had I ever shown up and granted them 3 wishes?
LOL.
Nope. Maybe 1 wish, if that wish was something I wanted to happen anyway. And if this ritual only allowed me to call 1 god, who would it be? Assuming I could even choose. Perhaps my son Asclepius would be able to heal me, but he couldn't very well fight the Roman Emperor's forces and the hordes of undead. Mars might grant us success on the battlefield, but he'd look at my wound and say something like,
"Yeah, rough break. Die bravely."
Here I was with purple lines of infection snaking down my arms, telling Meg not to worry.
"I don't know, Meg," I confessed. "You're right. I can't be sure everything will be okay. But I can promise you I'm not giving up. We've come this far. I'm not going to let a belly scratch stop us from defeating the triumvirate."
She had so much mucus dripping from her nostrils, she would have made Buster the Unicorn proud. She sniffled, wiping her upper lip with her knuckle.
"I don't want to lose somebody else."
My mental gears weren't turning at full speed. I had trouble wrapping my mind around the fact that by somebody else, Meg meant me. I recalled one of her early memories, which I'd witnessed in my dreams. She'd been forced to gaze upon her father's lifeless body on the steps of Grand Central Station, while Nero, his murderer, hugged her and promised to take care of her. I remembered how she'd betrayed me to Nero in the Grove of Dodona, out of fear of the beast, Nero's dark side, and how horrible she'd felt afterward, when we reunited in Indianapolis. Then she'd taken all her displaced anger and guilt and frustration and projected it onto Caligula. Which, to be honest, was a pretty good place to put it. Meg, being unable to lash out at Nero, had wanted so badly to kill Caligula. When Jason died instead, she was devastated. Now, aside from all the bad memories the Roman trappings of Camp Jupiter might have triggered for her, she was faced with the prospect of losing me. In a moment of shock,
like a unicorn staring me right in the face. I realized that despite all the grief Meg gave me, and the way she ordered me around, she cared for me. For the past 3 months, I had been her one constant friend, just as she had been mine. The only other person who might have come close was Peaches, Meg's fruit tree spirit minion, and we hadn't seen him since Indianapolis. At first, I'd assumed Peaches was just being temperamental about when he decided to appear, like most supernatural creatures. But if he had tried to follow us to Palm Springs, where even the cacti struggled to survive, I didn't relish a peach tree's odds of survival there, much less in the burning maze. Meg hadn't mentioned Peaches to me once since we were in the labyrinth. Now I realized his absence must have been weighing on her, along with all her other worries. What a horribly insufficient friend I had been. Come here. I held up my arms. Please? Meg hesitated. Still sniffling, she rose from her cot and trudged toward me. She fell into my hug like I was a comfy mattress. I grunted, surprised by how solid and heavy she was. She smelled of apple peels and mud, but I didn't mind. I didn't even mind the mucus and tears soaking my shoulder. I'd always wondered what it would be like to have a younger sibling. Sometimes I'd treated Artemis as my baby sister, since I'd been born a few minutes earlier, but that had been mostly to annoy her. With Meg, I felt as if it were actually true. I had someone who depended on me, who needed me around no matter how much we irritated each other. I thought about Hazel and Frank, and the washing away of curses. I supposed that kind of love could come from many different types of relationships.
Okay.
Meg pushed herself away, wiping her cheeks furiously.
Enough of that. You sleep. I'm going to get dinner or whatever.
For a long time after she left, I lay in my cot staring at the ceiling. Music floated up from the cafe. The soothing sounds of Horace Silver's piano, punctuated by the hiss of the espresso machine, accompanying Bombilo singing in two-headed harmony. After spending a few days with these noises, I found them soothing, even homey. I drifted off to sleep, hoping to have warm, fuzzy dreams about Meg and me skipping through sunlit fields with our elephant, unicorn, and metal greyhound friends. Instead, I found myself back with the Emperors. On my list of places I least wanted to be, Caligula's yacht ranked right up there with Tarquin's tomb, the eternal abyss of chaos, and the Limburger cheese factory in Liège, Belgium, where stinking gym socks went to feel better about themselves. Commodus lounged in a deck chair, an aluminum tanning bib around his neck, reflecting the afternoon sun directly onto his face. Sunglasses covered his scarred eyes. He wore only pink swim trunks and pink Crocs. I took absolutely no notice of the way the tanning oil glistened on his muscular bronzed body. Caligula stood nearby in his captain's uniform. White coat, dark slacks, and striped shirt, all crisply pressed. His cruel face looked almost angelic as he marveled at the contraption that now took up the entire aft deck. The artillery mortar was the size of an above-ground swimming pool, with a 2-foot-thick rim of dark iron and a diameter wide enough to drive a car through. Nestled in the barrel, a massive green sphere glowed like a giant radioactive hamster ball. Pandai rushed around the deck, blanket ears flopping, their furry hands moving at preternatural speeds as they plugged in cables and oiled gears at the base of the weapon. Some of the Pandai were young enough to have pure white fur, which made my heart hurt, reminding me of my brief friendship with Crest, the youthful aspiring musician who'd lost his life in the burning maze.
It's wonderful, Caligula beamed, circling the mortar. Is it ready for test firing?
Yes, Lord, said the Pandos boost. Of course, every sphere of Greek fire is very, very expensive, so...
Do it! Caligula yelled.
Boost yelped and scrambled to the control panel. Greek fire. I hated the stuff. And I was a sun god who rode a fiery chariot. Viscous, green, and impossible to extinguish. Greek fire was just plain nasty. A cupful could burn down an entire building. And that single glowing sphere held more than I'd ever seen in one place.
Oh, Commodus, Caligula called. You might want to pay attention to this.
I am fully attentive,
Commodus said, turning his face to better catch the sun. Caligula sighed.
Boost, you may proceed.
Boost called out instructions in his own language. His fellow Pandai turned cranks and spun dials, slowly swiveling the mortar until it pointed out to sea. Boost double-checked his readings on the control panel, then shouted,
Unus, duo, tres!
With a mighty boom, the mortar fired. The entire boat shuddered from the recoil. The giant hamster ball rocketed upward until it was a green marble in the sky, then plummeted toward the western horizon. The sky blazed emerald. A moment later, hot winds buffeted the ship with the smell of burning salt and cooked fish. In the distance, a geyser of green fire churned on the boiling sea.
Ooh, pretty.
Caligula grinned at Boost. And you have one missile for each ship?
Yes, Lord, as instructed.
The range?
Once we clear Treasure Island, we'll be able to bring all weapons to bear on Camp Jupiter, my lord. No magical defenses can stop such a massive volley. Total annihilation.
Good, Caligula said. That's my favorite kind.
But remember,
Commodus called from his deck chair, having not even turned to watch the explosion.
First we try a ground assault. Maybe they'll be wise and surrender. We want New Rome intact, and the Harpy and Cyclops taken alive if possible.
Yes, yes, Caligula said. If possible.
He seemed to savor those words like a beautiful lie. His eyes glittered in the green artificial sunset.
Either way, this will be fun.
I woke up alone, the sun baking my face. For a second, I thought I might be in a deck chair next to Commodus, a tanning bib around my neck. But no, the days when Commodus and I hung out together were long gone. I sat up, groggy, disoriented, and dehydrated. Why was it still light outside? Then I realized, judging from the angle of the sun coming in the room, it must have been about noon. Once again, I'd slept through the night and half a day. I still felt exhausted. I pressed gently on my bandaged gut. I was horrified to find the wound tender again. The purple lines of infection had darkened. This could only mean one thing. It was time for a long-sleeved shirt. No matter what happened over the next 24 hours, I would not add to Meg's worries. I would tough it out until the moment I keeled over. Wow. Who even was I? By the time I changed clothes and hobbled out of Bombilo's coffee shop, most of the Legion had gathered at the mess hall for lunch. As usual, the dining room bustled with activity. Demigods, grouped by cohort, reclined on couches around low tables, while Ore whisked overhead with platters of food and pitchers of drink. Hanging from the cedar rafters, wargame pennants and cohort standards rippled in the constant breeze. When they finished eating, diners rose cautiously and walked away, hunched over, lest they get decapitated by a flying plate of cold cuts. Except for the Larrys, of course. They didn't care what sort of delicacies flew through their ectoplasmic noggins. I spotted Frank at the officer's table, deep in conversation with Hazel and the rest of the Centurions. Reyna was nowhere in sight. Perhaps she was catching a nap or preparing for the afternoon's war drills. Given what we were facing tomorrow, Frank looked remarkably relaxed. As he chatted with his officers, he even cracked a smile, which seemed to put the others at ease. How simple it would be to destroy their fragile confidence, I thought, just by describing the flotilla of artillery yachts I'd seen in my dream. Not yet, I decided. No sense spoiling their meal.
Hey, Lester!
Lavinia yelled from across the room, waving me over as if I were her waiter. I joined her and Meg at the fifth cohort table. An aura deposited a goblet of water in my hand, then left a whole pitcher on the table. Apparently my dehydration was that obvious. Lavinia leaned forward, her eyebrows arched like pink and chestnut rainbows.
So is it true?
I frowned at Meg, wondering which of the many embarrassing stories about me she might have shared. She was too busy plowing through a row of hot dogs to pay me any mind. Is what true? I asked.
The shoes.
Shoes? Lavinia threw her hands in the air.
The dancing shoes of Terpsichore. Meg was telling us what happened on Caligula's yachts. She said you and that Piper girl saw a pair of Terpsichore shoes.
Oh. I had completely forgotten about those, or the fact that I'd told Meg about them. Strange, but the other events aboard Caligula's ships, getting captured, seeing Jason killed before our eyes, barely escaping with our lives, had eclipsed my memories of the Emperor's footwear collection.
Meg,
I said, of all the things you could have chosen to tell them, you told them about that.
Wasn't my idea.
Meg somehow managed to enunciate with half a hot dog in her mouth.
Lavinia likes shoes.
Well, what did you think I was going to ask about? Lavinia demanded. You tell me the Emperor has an entire boatload of shoes. Of course I'm going to wonder if you saw any dancing ones.
So it's true then, Lester?
I mean, yes, we saw a pair of...
Wow.
Lavinia sat back, crossed her arms, and glared at me.
Just wow. You wait until now to tell me this? Do you know how rare those shoes are? How important?
She seemed to choke on her own indignation.
Wow.
Around the table, Lavinia's comrades showed a mixture of reactions. Some rolled their eyes, some smirked. Some kept eating as if nothing Lavinia did could surprise them anymore. An older boy with shaggy brown hair dared to stick up for me.
Lavinia, Apollo has had a few other things going on.
Oh, my gods, Thomas, Lavinia shot back. Naturally, you wouldn't understand. You never take off those boots. Thomas frowned at his standard issue combat stompers.
What? They've got good arch support.
Yeesh.
Lavinia turned to Meg. We have to figure out a way to get aboard that ship and rescue those shoes.
Nah.
Meg sucked a glob of relish off her thumb.
Way too dangerous.
But...
Lavinia, I interrupted. You can't. She must have heard the fear and urgency in my voice. Over the past few days, I had developed a strange fondness for Lavinia. I didn't want to see her charge into a slaughter,
especially after my dream about those mortars primed with Greek fire. She ran her Star of David pendant back and forth on its chain. You've got new information? Dish. Before I could reply, a plate of food flew into my hands. The Ore had decided I needed chicken fingers and fries. Lots of them. Either that or they'd heard the word dish and taken it as an order. A moment later, Hazel and the other 5th cohort centurion joined us. A dark-haired young man with strange red stains around his mouth. Ah, yes, Dakota, child of Bacchus.
What's going on? Dakota asked.
Lester has news.
Lavinia stared at me expectantly, as if I might be withholding the location of Terpsichore's magical tutu, which, for the record, I hadn't seen in centuries. I took a deep breath. I wasn't sure if this was the right forum for sharing my dream. I should probably report it to the Praetors first. But Hazel nodded at me as if to say, go on. I decided that was good enough. I described what I'd seen. A top-of-the-line IKEA heavy mortar, fully assembled, shooting a giant hamster ball of green flaming death that blew up the Pacific Ocean. I explained that, apparently, the Emperors had 50 such mortars, one on each ship, which would be ready to obliterate Camp Jupiter as soon as they took up positions in the bay. Dakota's face turned as red as his mouth.
I need more Kool-Aid.
The fact that no goblets flew into his hand told me the Ore disagreed. Lavinia looked like she'd been slapped with one of her mother's ballet slippers. Meg kept eating hot dogs as if they might be the last ones she would ever get. Hazel chewed her bottom lip in concentration, perhaps trying to extract any good news from what I'd said. She seemed to find this harder than pulling diamonds from the ground. Okay, look, guys. We knew the Emperors were assembling secret weapons. At least now we know what those weapons are. I'll convey this information to the Praetors, but it doesn't change anything. You all did a great job in the morning drills. She hesitated, then generously decided not to add, except for Apollo, who slept through it all. And this afternoon, one of our war games will be about boarding enemy ships. We can get prepared. From the expressions around the table, I gathered the 5th cohort was not reassured. The Romans had never been known for their naval prowess. Last I'd checked, the Camp Jupiter Navy consisted of some old triremes they only used for mock naval battles in the Colosseum, and one rowboat they kept docked in Alameda. Drilling to board enemy ships would be less about practicing a workable battle plan and more about keeping the legionnaires busy so they wouldn't think about their impending doom. Thomas rubbed his forehead.
I hate my life.
Keep it together, Legionnaire, Hazel said. This is what we signed up for, defending the legacy of Rome.
From its own emperors,
Thomas said miserably.
I'm sorry to tell you, I put in, but the biggest threat to the Empire was often its own emperors. Nobody argued.
At the officer's table, Frank Zhang stood. All around the room, flying pitchers and platters froze in midair, waiting respectfully.
Legionnaires, Frank announced, managing a confident smile. Relay activities will recommence on the field of Mars in 20 minutes. Drill like your lives depend on it, because they do.
Chapter 21. See this right here, kids? This is how you don't do it. Questions? Class dismissed.
How's the wound? Hazel asked. I knew she meant well, but I was getting very tired of that question, and even more tired of the wound. We walked side by side out the main gates,
heading for the field of Mars. Just ahead of us, Meg cartwheeled down the road. Though how she did this without regurgitating the 4 hot dogs she'd eaten, I had no idea.
"Oh, you know," I said, in a terrible attempt to sound upbeat. "All things considered, I'm okay."
My old immortal self would have laughed at that.
Okay? Are you joking?
Over the last few months, I had drastically scaled back my expectations. At this point, okay meant still able to walk and breathe.
"I should have realized earlier," Hazel said. "Your death aura is getting stronger by the hour.
Can we not talk about my death aura?"
"Sorry, it's just, I wish Nico were here. He might know how to fix you."
I wouldn't have minded seeing Hazel's half-brother. Nico D'Angelo, son of Hades, had been quite valuable when we fought Nero at Camp Half-Blood. And of course, his boyfriend, my son Will Solis, was an excellent healer. Yet I suspected they wouldn't be able to help me any more than Prangel had. If Will and Nico were here, they would just be 2 more people for me to worry about. 2 more loved ones watching me with concern, wondering how long until I went full-on zombie.
"I appreciate the sentiment," I said. "But what is Lavinia doing?"
About 100 yards away, Lavinia and Don the Fawn stood on a bridge across the Little Tiber, which was very much not on the way to the Field of Mars, having what looked like a serious argument. Perhaps I shouldn't have brought this to Hazel's attention. Then again, if Lavinia wanted to go unnoticed, she should have chosen a different hair color, like camouflage, for instance, and not waved her arms around so much.
"I don't know."
Hazel's expression reminded me of a tired mother who had found her toddler trying to climb into the monkey exhibit for the 12th time. "Lavinia!" Lavinia looked over. She patted the air as if to say, "Just give me a minute," then went back to arguing with Don.
"Am I too young to get ulcers?"
Hazel wondered aloud. I had little occasion for humor, given all that was happening, but that comment made me laugh. As we got closer to the Field of Mars, I saw legionnaires breaking into cohorts, moving to different activities spread across the wasteland. One group was digging defensive trenches. Another had gathered on the shore of an artificial lake that hadn't been there yesterday, waiting to board 2 makeshift boats that looked nothing like Caligula's yachts. A third group sledded down a dirt hill on their shields. Hazel sighed. "That would be my group of delinquents, if you'll excuse me. I'm off to teach them how to slay ghouls." She jogged away, leaving me alone with my cartwheeling sidekick.
"So where do we go?"
I asked Meg. "Frank said we had, special jobs."
"Yep."
Meg pointed to the far end of the field, where the 5th cohort was waiting at a target range.
"You're teaching archery."
I stared at her. "I'm doing what now?"
"Frank taught the morning class, since you slept forever. Now it's your turn."
"But I can't teach as Lester, especially in my condition. Besides, Romans never rely on archery in combat. They think projectile weapons are beneath them."
"Gotta think in new ways if you want to beat the emperors," Meg said. "Like me. I'm weaponizing the unicorns."
Wait, what?"
"Later."
Meg skipped across the field toward a large riding ring, where the 1st cohort and a herd of unicorns were staring suspiciously at one another. I couldn't imagine how Meg planned to weaponize the nonviolent creatures, or who had given her permission to try. But I had a sudden horrible image of Romans and unicorns assaulting one another with large cheese graters.
I decided to mind my own business.
With a sigh, I turned toward the firing range and went to meet my new pupils. The only thing scarier than being bad at archery was discovering that I was suddenly good at it again. That may not sound like a problem, but since becoming mortal, I'd experienced a few random bursts of godly skill. Each time, my powers had quickly evaporated again, leaving me more bitter and disillusioned than ever. Sure, I may have fired a quiverful of amazing shots in Tarquin's tomb, that didn't mean I could do it again. If I tried to demonstrate proper shooting techniques in front of a whole cohort and ended up hitting one of Meg's unicorns in the butt, I would die of embarrassment long before the zombie poison got me. Okay, everyone, I said. I suppose we can start. Dakota was rummaging through his water-stained quiver, trying to find an arrow that wasn't warped. Apparently, he thought it was a great idea to store his archery supplies in the sauna. Thomas and another legionnaire, Marcus, were sword fighting with their bows. The legion standard bearer, Jacob, was drawing his bow with the butt of the arrow directly at eye level, which explained why his left eye was covered in a patch from the morning's lessons. He now seemed eager to blind himself completely.
Come on, guys, said Lavinia.
She had sneaked in late without being noticed, one of her superpowers, and took it upon herself to help me call the troops to order.
Apollo might know stuff.
This was how I knew I had hit rock bottom. The highest praise I could receive from a mortal was that I might know stuff. I cleared my throat. I'd faced much bigger audiences. Why was I so nervous? Oh, right. Because I was a horribly incompetent 16-year-old. So, let's talk about how to aim. My voice cracked naturally. Wide stance, full draw. Then find your target with your dominant eye, or in Jacob's case, with your one working eye. Aim along your sight pin, if you have one.
I don't have a sight pin, said Marcus.
It's the little circle thingy right there, Lavinia showed him.
I have a sight pin,
Marcus corrected himself. Then you let fly, I said. Like this. I shot at the nearest target, then at the target next farthest out, then at the next, firing again and again in a kind of trance. Only after my 20th shot did I realize I'd landed all bullseyes, two in each target, the farthest about 200 yards away. Child's play for Apollo. For Lester? Quite impossible. The legionnaires stared at me, their mouths hanging open.
We're supposed to do that? Dakota demanded.
Lavinia punched my forearm.
See you guys? I told you Apollo doesn't suck that much.
I had to agree with her. I felt oddly not suckish. The display of marksmanship hadn't drained my energy, nor did it feel like the temporary bursts of godly power I'd experienced before. I was tempted to ask for another quiver to see if I could keep shooting at the same skill level, but I was afraid to press my luck.
So, I faltered, I don't expect you to be that good right away. I was only demonstrating what's possible with a lot of practice. Let's give it a try, shall we?
I was relieved to take the focus off myself. I organized the cohort into a firing line and made my way down the ranks, offering advice. Despite his warped arrows, Dakota was not terrible. He actually hit the target a few times. Jacob managed not to blind himself in the other eye. Thomas and Marcus sent most of their arrows skittering across the dirt, ricocheting off rocks and into the trenches, which elicited shouts of, "Hey, watch it!" from the ditch-digging fourth cohort.
After an hour of frustration with a regular bow, Lavinia gave up and pulled out her monoballista. Her first bolt knocked down the 50-yard target.
"Why do you insist on using that slow-loading monstrosity?" I asked. "If you're so ADHD, wouldn't a regular bow give you more instant satisfaction?"
Lavinia shrugged.
"Maybe, but the monoballista makes a statement. Speaking of which,"
she leaned toward me, her expression turning serious,
"I need to talk to you."
"That doesn't sound good."
"No, it's not. I—"
In the distance, a horn blew.
"Okay, guys," Dakota called. "Time to rotate activities. Good team effort."
Lavinia punched me in the arm again.
"Later, Lester."
The fifth cohort dropped their weapons and ran toward the next activity, leaving me to retrieve all their arrows. Cretans. The rest of the afternoon, I stayed at the firing range, working with each cohort in turn. As the hours wore on, both the shooting and the teaching became less intimidating for me. By the time I was wrapping up work with my last group, the first cohort, I was convinced that my improved archery skills were here to stay. I didn't know why. I still couldn't shoot at my old godly level, but I was definitely better now than the average demigod archer or Olympic gold medalist. I had started to jive. I considered pulling out the arrow of Dodona to brag, "See what I can do?" But I didn't want to jinx myself. Besides, knowing that I was dying of zombie poison on the eve of a major battle took some of the thrill out of being able to shoot bullseyes again. The Romans were duly impressed. Some of them even learned a little, like how to fire an arrow without blinding yourself or killing the guy next to you. Still, I could tell they were more excited about the other activities they'd done. I overheard a lot of whispering about unicorns and Hazel's super-secret ghoul-fighting techniques. Larry from the third cohort had enjoyed boarding ships so much, he declared that he wanted to be a pirate when he grew up. I suspected most of the Legionnaires had even enjoyed ditch digging more than my class. It was late evening when the final horn blew, and the cohorts tromped back to camp. I was hungry and exhausted. I wondered if this was how mortal teachers felt after a full day of classes. If so, I didn't see how they managed. I hoped they were richly compensated with gold, diamonds, and rare spices. At least the cohort seemed to be in an upbeat mood. If the praetor's goal had been to take the troops' minds off their fears and raise morale on the eve of battle, then our afternoon had been a success. If the goal had been to train the Legion to successfully repel our enemies, then I was less than hopeful. Also, all day long, everyone had carefully avoided addressing the worst thing about tomorrow's attack. The Romans would have to face their former comrades, returned as zombies under Tarquin's control. I remembered how hard it had been for Lavinia to shoot down Bobby with her crossbow in the tomb. I wondered how the Legion's morale would hold up once they faced the same ethical dilemma times 50 or 60. I was turning onto the Via Principalis on my way to the mess hall when a voice said, "Psst." Lurking in the alley between Bombillo's cafe and the chariot repair shop were Lavinia and Don. The Fawn was wearing an honest-to-God's trench coat over his tie-dyed t-shirt, as if that made him look inconspicuous. Lavinia wore a black cap over her pink hair.
"Come here,"
she hissed.
"But dinner, we need you."
"Is this a mugging?"
She marched over, grabbed my arm, and pulled me into the shadows.
"Don't worry, dude,"
Don told me.
"It's not a mugging, but like, if you do have any spare change..."
"Shut up, Don," said Lavinia.
"I'll shut up,"
Don agreed. "Lester," Lavinia said,
You need to come with us.
Lavinia, I'm tired. I'm hungry. And I have no spare change. Can't it please wait?
No. Because tomorrow, we might all die, and this is important. We're sneaking out.
Sneaking out?
Yeah, Don said. It's when you're sneaking, and you go out.
Why? I demanded.
You'll see. Lavinia's tone was ominous, as if she couldn't explain what my coffin looked like. I had to admire it with my own eyes.
What if we get caught?
Oh, Don perked up. I know this one. For a first offense, it's latrine duty for a month. But see, if we all die tomorrow, it won't matter.
With that happy news, Lavinia and Don grabbed my hands and dragged me farther into the darkness. Chapter 22. I sing of dead plants and heroic shrubberies. Inspiring stuff. Sneaking out of a Roman military camp should not have been so easy. Once we were safely through a hole in the fence, down a trench, through a tunnel, past the pickets, and out of sight of the camp's sentry towers, Don was happy to explain how he'd arranged it all.
Dude, the place is designed to keep out armies. It's not meant to keep in individual legionnaires, or keep out, you know, the occasional well-meaning fawn who's just looking for a hot meal. If you know the patrol schedule and are willing to keep changing up your entry points, it's easy.
That seems remarkably